now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, does Antonio Conte's appointment mean Tottenham are no longer Spursy? Can Chelsea's fringe players make their mark? Will City put United to the sword in the Manchester derby? And do Newcastle United have a plan? This is The Game. Hello again, welcome back to the Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wisencroft in London and in person alongside Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark. Ian Hawkey joins us from Spain as well. This is the first time since I started doing this podcast that I've been in the same room with Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark. Gentlemen, you are beautiful.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I'm very happy about this. Ian, I wish you were here as well. Listen, thank you all for listening. But yes, it is a momentous occasion for us on the Game Podcast and myself in particular. So I'm going to enjoy this one. Hope you enjoy it too. Loads for us to discuss. We're, of course, reflecting on a big week in the Champions League. Let's start with Liverpool. They've cruised into the last 16 with a 2-0 win over 10-man Atletico Madrid. And to be honest, it really should have been more on the evening. Was one once again, eventful. Two assists for Trent Alexander-Arnold. You got a couple of the headlines, as did the red card for Atletico Madrid's Felipe, a straight red card as well as Luis Suarez getting booed back at Anfield as well. Where should we begin? Where should we begin, Tom?
The red card for me. It's got to be the red card because, again, I found myself watching a Liverpool-Atleti game and just thinking, oh, what a shame. What a shame they've lost another man to a slightly controversial red card decision, because it did spoil it. It was great fun watching Liverpool play that kind of fast, intense way that they play and create so many chances. As you say, it should have been far more. But I did find myself rueing the red card slightly because I can't quite work it out. Does anyone know whether it was for the foul or whether it's for the walk away? Or
it was for the foul.
I mean,
which I'm disappointed about. I think I would have quite enjoyed it if it had been just for the fact he was ignoring him so blatantly. I'm just going to roll two yellow cards into one here just to make it, you know, for double impact. I would have quite liked that because there's a bit too much disrespect of referees, and that was clear. But
it was a red?
It wasn't a red. It wasn't.
It wasn't a red. No. It was a red.
Nah, what?
It was a red.
Why? Because he went down the back of his leg.
It was a red. Yeah.
I think
and
that
the
was,
ball was
I think that
about
was
10 feet ahead.
No, I think it was like a classic clip the ankle.
But this is the point. This is that's dangerous play. It's dangerous play. You can't say it was a bit of an accident. A lot of bad tackles are a bit of an accident. No one really intends to go over the ball, for example, and hurt someone. But when you do, it's a red card.
This must be deja vu for Ian. We're going to have to bring him in as a mediator again. We've got another red card, another Liverpool Atleti game.
I think more cynical fouls where players don't have any intent to get the ball and they're just taking a player out should be red cards, because you can injure someone. It's violent conduct. Ian Hawkey, red card adjudicator. We'll come to Gregor in a minute. He's our defensive adjudicator. Ian, what did you think?
I think there's a new criteria, a Champions League red card. No, we have had a few of these, which is why we end up talking about it on Thursdays. What do people think about the Hummels one? Because that was also, I think, debatable under the terms of, well, I suppose broadly harm. But he went off and it was probably slightly worse than Felipe's. But
he didn't really catch the player. He slid sort of 2 feet ahead of the player because he wanted to block where he thought the ball was going. Anthony beat him to it, tried a little trick, and then, I don't know, just went over the top of him. He never really caught the player. And I think given a straight red card, when you don't catch the player, unless it's something that is, you know, real intent to hurt someone, for me, shouldn't be given as a red card. I thought that was harsh. Don't laugh at me. I'm not flip-flopping.
No, I'm just learning as well as how beautiful you are in person, Hugh. I'm realising this is where you and I are going to differ. Because I actually thought the Hummels one was probably more of a red card because of the dangerous intent and the way he kind of went in real time. You thought you know, if he'd caught him, he could have really hurt him. Whereas the Felipe one is, he catches him, but he was just trying to like flick his ankles, and it wasn't, you know, to me, that's a yellow, and Hummels is more of a red. But still soft for me, but more of a red.
So we've got one Hummels red,
Felipe yellow. Yep.
Gregor?
Neither red.
Both yellow.
There's a lad brought up in the football league.
True. They're both getting a borderline because it wasn't just a clip of the ankles. It was forceful. You know, he did give him a fair old swipe. But I still think that's too much to be deemed a straight red card. And I think Hummels, I don't think it was any malicious intent. I don't know, that doesn't matter now. And you go with a straight leg, you're risking it. But I still think, as you say, he didn't really make much contact. And for that reason, yellow would have been good enough. But I'm a defender.
Ian?
I'm with the Hummels red, Felipe yellow. I'm also quite enjoying the huge difference between the two players' reactions. Hummels was utter chivalry afterwards, wasn't he? He had a chat with Anthony, the player who'd been endangered, as it were. He was civil to the referee. Whereas Felipe, as you said, was just, you know, schoolboy petulance, wasn't he?
Ian, is this the Simeone way again? You know, is this more of what you see week in, week out with Atleti, or is it just that they seem to get worked up by playing Liverpool?
Well, I mean, it's clearly a classic grudge match now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would say it's actually not the Simeone way. It's completely the opposite. I mean, the classic Simeone, the rise of Atletico, was about players like Diego Godin, who knew absolutely sensitively the line between yellow and red and were really crafty about it. I think in these last two games against Liverpool, we've seen Griezmann unlucky, but you know the rules were applied correctly. And Hermoso penalty in the first game in Madrid, which was a panicking centre half, wasn't it? And similarly, Felipe, there was an element of misjudgment, which I think all the time now, Atletico's defence is being compared very unfavourably with what is supposed to be the sort of standard of this club. And I think he doesn't have the quality of centre-halves that he used to have.
I've got to say, I've been watching Atletico's time in the Champions League, at least. They're not the same team, are they, Ian? You think about Antonio Conte coming to England, you think about some of the great managers in the Premier League, and you wonder how much further Diego Simeone can take Atletico Madrid before there's maybe a breakup of the relationship, or another team spots an opportunity to maybe prize him away and give him a new challenge. Where do you think we stand with that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And we're in slightly unprecedented territory. Next month, it'll be the 10th anniversary of his being in charge, which is just a length of time that you just don't hear of anymore. He has set himself the challenge of reshaping Atletico, making them value possession of the ball more. And he's got some really good attacking players now. You know, he's got Joao Felix, he's got Griezmann back. They are obliged to play a different way. They're also obliged to be slightly more surprising to opponents. But it is a difficult transition. I would point out that they are the Spanish champions, so it's not as if they're falling apart or the thing hasn't developed at all. And I think personally, you're right, for Simeone, there must be the question soon, what am I as a manager? Am I simply Atletico through and through, and this is going to be a sort of Ferguson-esque dynasty, and I am going to show that I can really reinvent teams every 5 years or so? Or do I actually need to move to discover a bit more of myself as a manager? I would say that the person who makes this decision will be Simeone. You know, he has enormous power at that club, and he is by far the most important individual in the way.
I think we should point out that Liverpool were outstanding in the first half an hour. You know, we've spoken for quite a long time about this game now.
It's familiar now.
Mentioned how blistering they were in that first half an hour. As you say, Trent Alexander-Arnold was just, his deliveries were sublime. I thought the midfield was brilliant as well. I thought Oxlade-Chamberlain driving in those little kind of pockets inside channels, Henderson joining in. You talk about the Liverpool fullbacks doing so much, but they're kind of on par with Oxlade-Chamberlain and Henderson. It's almost like they join in to make like a five-man midfield. The two men split wide and they can find little holes in between them. So it's so hard to play against. We're talking about, yes, Atletico normally are so compact and resolute and very hard to break through. But Liverpool, at that pace and on that form, my God, they're hard to match, really.
they're looking like the real deal this season in the Champions League and possibly the Premier League as well. Could be their biggest rivals this season, Manchester City. They looked a lot better last night. They swept aside Club Brugge 4-1 to bounce back from two poor results by their high standards. City now need a point from their last two games in the group to seal a spot in the last 16 for the ninth straight season. But Kevin De Bruyne, their Belgian midfielder, didn't start the game. He's lacking in some form right now. How big an issue could that be over the course of the season if it persists for Manchester City, Tom?
It would be a massive issue if it persists. I don't think it will. I think this is actually Pep managing his star quite sensibly. You know, you have to remember De Bruyne had two separate, fairly severe injuries, one in the Champions League final and then again in the Euros. He picked up that ankle knock, which has affected him. I was looking at the stats this morning, and even just taking the Premier League, he's played half the number of minutes so far this season as Pep's, you know, rotated. He's tried Jack Grealish in different positions. And I think actually it could come good for City if towards the Christmas period, a lot of run of games and into the new year, you suddenly have a Kevin De Bruyne back on song. I don't think they need to worry about it just yet. But obviously the number of injuries he's had could be a concern, but I think it's Pep just managing his star quite sensibly.
City or any team on the planet would want a fitting rearing Kevin De Bruyne, but they've coped without him in the past. They won the league in the past without him for most of the season. And I also would have to point out that the form Phil Foden's in, it's just like he's alleviating that burden massively. So yes, of course, I agree with Tom. I think he's managing his minutes. He doesn't look like he's kind of at full health yet, and I think probably Pep's just managing him and hoping to see the best of him soon.
It was put to Pep Guardiola that RB Leipzig had done Manchester City a favour by getting a draw against Paris Saint-Germain, Ian. He responded by saying, when you're at Manchester City, you realise nobody helps you. You know, never wants to make a routine win over Bruges go away that boring. Wants a few headlines, doesn't he, Pep? Do you understand what he means by that?
I can think of a very, very long list of clubs who would feel that they have less favours than Manchester City in all things. But I think, you know, Pep is sensitive enough to know that there is a quite entrenched siege mentality at Manchester City when it comes to the Champions League and UEFA. And it's, you know, it does him no harm to channel that and to, you know, just remind fans, maybe some players if necessary, that while they do have a lot of advantages, there's a perception that UEFA particularly don't give them any advantages. So, I think it's just a little mind game tease, isn't it?
Yeah, Manchester City and UEFA get along just fine, don't they? So I'm sure it's not too much. Anyway, Manchester City looking good for qualification. Tuesday's football saw Chelsea grind out a 1-0 win over Malmo. Callum Hudson-Odoi impressed beautifully, laying on a goal for Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Their manager Thomas Tuchel very impressed as well. Hakim Ziyech has promised that there's going to be more from him in a Chelsea shirt. Billy Gilmore, Conor Gallagher, Armando Broha, all on loan, but very likely to have some Chelsea future. I don't know what you guys think about it. Will any of those players make it, if you like, at Chelsea? Because they'll also, I think, have many suitors come the January transfer window and definitely in the summer as well. What do you think, Gregor?
Yeah, well, it depends what making it is for Chelsea now, I suppose. You know, it's like
having a longish career at the club.
Yeah, well, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, I suppose you could say he has, but without playing enough football.
His contract suggests he has, yeah.
Yeah. they all have very lengthy contracts. It's great to be a Chelsea youth team player of a certain standard. Hudson-Odoi is always, you know, he comes in and you see these flashes and you think he's threatening, that he could be one that would have a long-term future and be a thrilling prospect. But then he dips off and you just see, you know, Tuchel sometimes calls him out a little bit, saying, I think I need more from him. But he's got it in the locker too. And beyond that, yes, all these guys on loan, they can dip in and out of the team. Chelsea's strength and depth is just incredible right now. Players they can call upon from the academy and from elsewhere as well, just from the amount of money they've spent over the years. Their squad is so strong and deep at the moment.
Would you want to stay at the club if you were those players? Let's think of Billy Gilmore, who's obviously at Norwich on loan, but Conor Gallagher, who's had the opportunity to play football, he's impressing. Armando Broha's impressing for club and country as well. Hakim Ziyech has already impressed at Ajax and isn't really getting the opportunities to start regularly. And then Callum Hudson-Odoi, I mean, all of these players could be doing more every weekend than what we actually see from them at the moment.
It's a conundrum. I mean, you look at Mason Mount's the obvious player that we've not spoken about so far, and he's taken it upon himself. He's done it. He's made himself undroppable for several managers now, and it's whether the players have got it within them and the kind of mentality, I think, to produce their very best, those high levels every single week. I'd say, looking at Conor Gallagher now, he's someone who you'd think has that kind of same bit of steel about him, that same mentality. So potentially, if he keeps developing at the rate he is, he could be someone else who has a big future at Chelsea.
Call me a massive cynic, but I think all those players you've outlined are heading down the Kurt Zouma route for me, Hugh. I think, you know, a bit of time in the Chelsea team to raise your profile and then probably move to a rival, a mid-table rival for about 30 million. I mean, that's a transfer that's worked for everyone. It's worked for Zouma. He's gone to a club like West Ham. He's playing regularly. He looks good. And Chelsea have made 30 million. We there were lots of these players over the years who Chelsea haven't given a chance to and therefore haven't quite made any money on in terms of their investment. I think you'd be looking at these players. Obviously, the Hudson-Odoi issue is a fascinating one because they were so desperate to keep him for so long and believed in his potential. But I wouldn't be surprised, yes, as much as we were loving Conor Gallagher the other day, if he was given a bit of a shot in the Chelsea team but then ends up transferring somewhere for 40 million. I don't know, call me a massive cynic, but that to me seems you're either Mason Mount or you're Kurt Zouma, and I think of those players listed, they're probably heading down the Zouma route.
I have to say, watching Chelsea the last couple of weeks and seeing how many of them have been playing the academy kind of graduates, it crossed my mind, like, how many players given this opportunity over the years that hasn't really been forthcoming? How many Chelsea academy players who've been so highly thought of in the past and haven't got this opportunity would have flourished in the first team?
Well, how many transfer embargoes have there been?
Exactly, that can open the gates for them. But, you know, these players have to go up to this level and show they can step up and match it. And you improve when you're playing around better players. That's a fact. So, you know, there might be more of these guys in the academy that have just missed. You know, Trevor Chalaba, I watched him on loan at Huddersfield and he didn't pull up any trees. And now he's been thrown into the team as a centre half. And you think, he's another one who's going to get a 5-year contract. And you think,
just as you mentioned that, because you've played in the EFL, I mean, there are a few who haven't pulled up trees on loan, especially in the Championship,
exactly,
as young players. Emil Smith Rowe, for example, you know, who is just transformed in an Arsenal shirt. What's the difference?
You're playing around better players. I also think the way that you're developed in academies now is very different to the kind of rough and tumble of even the Championship. More than anything, it's playing alongside better players. You know, I started Nottingham Forest. I played alongside better players and I think I played better football there. When you drop down, you've got to excel. You've got to be the best player if you want to progress. Not everyone plays like that. Most players just excel in a better team. And I think you're seeing that with someone like Chalaba.
Right, let's move on to Manchester United next. I've left them until now because, frankly, we speak about Manchester United all the time of late on the Game podcast. Cristiano Ronaldo, once again, scoring a late equaliser, this one in injury time, to give Manchester United a massive point away at Atalanta. It leaves them top of Group F with a huge game coming at Villarreal next. Rafael Varane went off with injury. He's now out for a month, missing from the heart of the Manchester United defence, which, by the way, looks very shaky without him. But there have been, Ian, criticisms of late of how Manchester United can get the best out of their team whilst also getting the best out of Cristiano Ronaldo. 9 goals already for the Portuguese. Is he less of a problem than we thought he was going to be?
I've never really bought into this idea that when Ronaldo arrived, a huge problem was inherited. He has done astonishingly well. Without his goals, they would be bottom of their Champions League group. I'm pretty sure that's a fact, yes. I think this debate starts from the wrong place sometimes. He's not going to do so much of the rigorous defensive work from his position, but he hasn't at the clubs he's been at really for the last 10 years. I think that's something that Manchester United really should have the resources and the cleverness to sort out. He's he's already invaluable, isn't he?
I think he is, but he's rescuing Manchester United right now. It wasn't meant to be like that. They were meant to dominate teams. They were meant to play free-flowing, beautiful football. He was just meant to be, you know, the icing on the cake, you know, the pièce de résistance. He was meant to finish things off. And although he's playing fantastically well, the team isn't. It was in utter disarray. It was all over the place. It was shambolic. And I think that is a major issue. I don't know if Ronaldo's the cause. All I'm saying is it's happened since he arrived.
It has, but it's been happening for a long time. It was happening long before he arrived, Hugh. But let's be honest, And I think he has only added to that triumph element that we've talked about before with Manchester United, particularly in the Champions League. It's triumph and disaster. It's, you know, euphoria and utter misery. It's the only, those are the two options, and you keep going until you eventually get knocked out, probably in the quarterfinals, by a team that you probably would expect United to beat. I think, just echoing Ian's point, I was looking at the stats this morning. Ronaldo's played more minutes in the Champions League than any other outfield player for United this season. That says a hell of a lot about his importance. And I think that that goal, that equalising goal, it was interesting how, obviously, it took a bit of luck in terms of Mason Greenwood, I think, being able to flick the ball up to him for the volley.
It also hit the referee in the build-up to the goal, and he didn't stop play, which was quite odd.
And it came, it came from the kind of
not complaining.
Ronaldo, Roy of the Rovers type run, didn't it? Where I can't trust any of you lot. And where's my mate Bruno Fernandes to give me an assist, and otherwise you're all hopeless. Which is that's the only problem, isn't it? You know, you were talking about Ronaldo coming in. United yet still, to me, haven't geared their team towards playing to Ronaldo. They still don't put crosses into the box for one of the best headers of a ball that the game has ever seen, in my opinion. They still don't have people out wide sending balls into him, apart from that Luke Shaw, I think, who put in the cross for the winner at home. The late winner, I think it was. So you're going to have this. But as Ian says, he's probably not the problem, I don't think.
The first goal, though, was exquisite. The kind of speed and interplay around his little kind of backheel touch. When you put so many good players on the pitch, that's what they can produce sometimes. But it's just the other, you know, 89 minutes that are the issue.
I've got mates calling Manchester United Moments FC because they play in moments. You know, they have the special moments, but the rest of the time, they're pretty atrocious. Actually, I thought this particular performance against Atalanta had more issues that we haven't seen before. I know he changed the system. He had Varane come off with the injury. He then changed system to a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3, if you like, and the players didn't really seem to know what they were doing at all for a lot of that game. No, I know we've said
where
it
have
before.
We heard that before?
No, I know we've said it before, but it just looked like a new way of not knowing what they were doing. You know, like, you know, you had Marcus Rashford, you know, when there were two up front at the start of the game, and he would just be on the left wing as if it was a 4-3-3. He wasn't playing through the middle, so he got taken off. Cavani came on, stayed through the middle of the pitch. Manchester United looked much better. But you had periods where centre backs were galloping down the touchline, taking people on. You had strikers picking the ball up, you know, in the defensive midfield area. You had Eric Bailly flying through the penalty area like he was the goalkeeper, but obviously using his feet. I mean, they're like eight last-ditch challenges or whatever. I thought Manchester United were pretty all over the place, I've got to say. And you wouldn't expect that from any team at that level. Doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a team from Kazakhstan or a team from Manchester. You know, it doesn't make any difference. You'd expect organisation. Come on, it's the Champions League.
You've just described a team from Manchester where everybody's doing unorthodox, unexpected things. How about Manchester City? João Cancelo, the left-back who does everything. Phil Foden, who's a brilliant deep midfielder and brilliant in the penalty area. This is a much better team, Manchester City, sure. But the idea that you can somehow interpret every piece of positional unorthodoxy at Manchester United as some sort of state of confusion, I think is a little unfair.
Right, so you're saying it was all part of the master plan?
No, absolutely not. No, they are chaotic and you know, look short of confidence when they don't have the ball sometimes. But I think you're a little extreme about this sometimes.
So all in all, a positive performance.
I was just going to say, I think the space that Zapata was left with probably wasn't part of the plan. Maguire trying to hear over to fill a gap that was just
chasm. What's going on with Harry Maguire?
I don't know. He's like, it's some kind of sign of existential crisis at the moment. It's very strange. He had this beginning of last season, kind of, was it? And then he responded brilliantly, and I think he performed brilliant for England as well during the summer. And this has come from nowhere, but he doesn't look himself. And you know, the loss of Varane for a month is going to be another huge blow, particularly with the derby coming up.
Phil Jones is fit. Don't worry, guys. Phil Jones is fit. He'll be back. I think we said a few weeks, or rather last week, that Solskjaer had three games to save his job. So we've had two of them now. He beat Spurs 3-0. He's rescued a 2-2 draw at Atalanta. And he's got the big Manchester derby this weekend. Before we talk about those three games and whether whatever result happens will save his job, do we think Manchester United are going to get embarrassed again this weekend?
No, I don't think they will. I don't think it can't happen again. no way. I think the players...
No way. You're trying to convince yourself.
I know. Well, I just don't see how tactically, and also even just the players' professional pride, which seemed to be so lacking in that Liverpool game, I don't see how they can put in a similar kind of performance and get turned over in the same way. I also think sometimes that kind of performance is geared to Liverpool, who do this crash, bang, wallop, we're 3-0 up against you so well. City sometimes are a bit more measured and a bit more considered and play at a slightly slower pace sometimes, which allows you maybe to get more men behind the ball and will allow United to just lose 3-1, which will be okay.
Now, there's a reason I asked if it would be an embarrassment again, because it's not about the scoreline per se. I went to a game that Manchester City won 2-0 at Old Trafford in the Premier League, where Manchester United barely touched the ball, and that was an embarrassment.
They were keeping it in the corner for the last 10 minutes.
Might not have been on the scoreline, but Manchester United could not get the ball back from Manchester City, and at Old Trafford, that would be deemed an embarrassment. So I looked at the performance against Atalanta and thought, in the words of Paul Scholes, if you play like that against Manchester City, see what happens. You know, I don't know. I'm just asking the question anyway. What do you think, Gregor?
It's eminently possible, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, watching that game, I watched them play Atalanta twice, and you just see a more intelligently coached team. You don't see necessarily a better group of players, I don't think. But you see a team that, when they lose possession, they burst their gut to get back behind the ball. And then they don't just let the team have the ball in front of them either. They go and press and they work really hard, and you can see that they know what they're doing. And they're fast on the break. Zapata was a big threat, I thought. Look, we've discussed this so many times. I don't think even if they are embarrassed that Ollie's going to lose his job. I think he's done enough in the last couple of games just to put that conversation to bed, because that's all it takes in Man United. I think if he lost these two games, had the derby coming up, you're looking at it, you're getting sort of itchy fingers on the trigger. But he's done enough, as he always does.
Ian, what do you think about it? If it's a comfortable victory for Manchester City, is that enough to keep Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in the job? And how do you think the game will go?
I think that's the likeliest scenario, a comfortable victory for Manchester City. I think it's become very, very clear that the instinct is to trust in the current manager, and it's going to take something heavy to change that. And I think possibly as important as humiliating outcomes against local rivals is the Champions League. And, you know, they are now on par to qualify. So, you know, that is an important box ticked. Gregor makes the point that Atalanta are a very good team. So, you know, drawing 2-2 there is not a bad result, really.
I mean, they've got Chelsea coming up as well. But in between City and Chelsea, they've got Watford and Villarreal. As long as they probably beat Watford and maybe get even a draw away at Villarreal, he'll be fine. Honestly, I don't see it changing.
We'll react to the Manchester derby coming up this Saturday on Monday's episode of the Game Podcast. But remember, if you're enjoying us, rate us, leave us a review, and of course, make sure you're subscribed. Up next, we'll talk Spurs and Newcastle's managerial positions.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
And Antonio Conte is the new Spurs manager, replacing Nuno Espirito Santo, who lost his job earlier this week. The former Chelsea, Juventus and Inter Milan boss signs an 18-month deal with the possibility of extending for a further year. The Italian says he wants to bring consistency to the team. He also said he didn't join in the summer when the pair were linked because of the emotional fallout of his departure from Inter Milan. Now, some Spurs fans, you know who you are, already targeting a place in the top four this season. Yeah, I've seen your tweets. In the next 30 months, the question is, what is success for Antonio Conte at Spurs and how do you think he will achieve it? Ian, I'm going to start with you on this.
Clearly, top four would be a good measure of success this season. Probably a long shot. But there's a wider thing with Conte. You know, what he does is win domestic titles quite quickly with all the club sides he's taken over. What he doesn't do is do very well in Europe. Now, Spurs are in the bottom tier of Europe this season. And, you know, maybe that will be, the Conference League will be his first European trophy. But he's not going to win the Premier League in this 18-month initial period, is he? So in his own mind, he will see the potential for Tottenham to be challenging for the Premier League, which they were not so long ago, last time, 4 or 5 years ago. But he's identified the right thing, hasn't he? You know, if he starts making them consistent, then that's a start, that's a base. And then dreams of the top four start looking more and more realistic. He's also made it very clear that money will have to be spent because there's a lot of refreshing to do with this team. And he will have a say in that, and it'll be a noisy and probably argumentative say.
Ian, it's all right if you say the EFL Cup. You know, you don't have to meander towards no answer at all.
Yeah, that would be a bonus. And you know, he'd enjoy that initially and immediately say it was a stepping stone to something else. But I suppose a domestic cup would keep people quiet for a while.
Just on the spending, Ian, how much do you think he needs to invest in this Spurs squad to reach that target of top four?
Oh, I, these things are hard to put a figure on, aren't they? What Conte will be able to do is attract people. Some people perhaps who've played with him before, I'm thinking of Inter's need probably to move on players, two or three of whom would like to work with Conte again. This, how much does he have to spend, depends a lot on what Spurs get out of the door as well, as it always will with that club. There are some very valuable assets at Tottenham, some of whose value is diminishing. It's a complicated equation on who comes in and who goes out. But, you know, we are talking in excess of 100 million, I think, to make them genuinely competitive.
In the next 30 months, Tom, what does success look like for Antonio Conte and what will he need to achieve it?
More than 100 million for a start, probably 200 million as just a base level, to be honest. I honestly think if he gets top four in that second season, that'll be pretty good. I mean, looking on the outside, we're talking about Conte, Ian's talking about him, wins titles. That, to me, is the only way it makes sense. A short-term deal, win-win for both. You get a bit more experience in the Premier League, get us into the top four, and then you probably take a bigger job. That's no offence to Tottenham fans, don't send me angry tweets, but let's be honest, this is a weak squad. He'll do well to get them into the top six this season, I think. When you look at the Premier League as it is, with West Ham really strong.
Leicester.
You know, even, dare I say, Arsenal are doing okay for the minute. Mm. Again, Tottenham fans, don't send me angry tweets. But, you know, Manchester United will stumble their way into the fourth place and it'll be a real scrap for them to get into the top six this season. And so then you do come back to a cup competition, which doesn't feel very Antonio Conte to be like, right, we're going to focus on the EFL Cup. They've got West Ham in the next round, by the way. That won't be easy either. I genuinely think that can only be the way it makes sense, is for that second season. Get us in the top six this season, get us in the top four the season after that, and we'll wave you off to Real Madrid or Man United or somewhere else. Thanks very much.
You're speaking with such realism here. I can't see him having accepted this job without a bit of a war chest.
And what's a war chest?
I'm not going to put a number on it.
Oh, come on. Oh, blue, God. Boring. On, put a matter? Number on it.
It does matter. How many players do you think they need to challenge the squads of Manchester United, Manchester City, Chelsea and Liverpool?
Half a dozen. I can't see why he would have accepted this job without a guarantee of having money to spend. He's not someone, you know, there's that quote he said where, you know, he can accept there being a 1% chance of him not winning the title, basically, when he goes into a job. But, you know, he won't see it as any more than that. So I think if he's being realistic at the moment at Spurs, it's a fair bit bigger than 1%. And it would be probably for the next year. But
he's got a 1% chance of winning it rather than of not winning it.
Yeah, exactly. It's also easy to get swept up. He's the best out-of-work manager in the world just now. It's easy to get swept up in his record at, like, you know, Juventus finished seventh the season before he came, and the next season they went unbeaten to win the league. Chelsea finished 10th under Mourinho and Hiddink'd. The next season they won the league. Everyone talks about the 3-5-2, but they scored 85 goals as well. They were a formidable team, like, by far and away the best team in the country that year. And at Inter, they'd been 9 years without winning the Scudetto. His first season, improved them by 13 points. Second season, champions. He's had money to spend. He has. There's no two ways about that. If he's given money to spend, he will greatly improve. There's another thing people have said. This is not hugely original, but he's basically what Tottenham thought they were getting when they hired Mourinho. But, like, Mourinho is a busted flush. 10 years ago, hiring Mourinho would have been a massive coup. It still was as a name, but he's not the same force. Conte is. He still is. He's very current. And look, I'd be hugely excited for Spurs because it's a change in direction too. I think it's a change in direction. As I say, for that reason, he would not have accepted this job without guarantees that he could put together a team that was able to compete for the Premier League title.
I love doing predictions on this podcast.
Yeah, so,
the very simple. It's just a one-word answer, gentlemen. Ian, will Antonio Conte be a success at Spurs?
Yes, but less successful than at his previous clubs.
Tom?
Yes, I think he'll spend money. I think he'll get them into the top four in the second season, and that's success.
Gregor?
Yes.
Unbelievable.
I don't have to qualify it.
Do you know, I would say I don't think he will. I put one big caveat on that. Solskjaer is the great leveller in the race for the Champions League. So if he continues to have Manchester United play the way that they're playing, that opens the door massively and improves Spurs' chances of reaching the top four, whether it's this season or next season. The other thing that I would say is I think he can do it and be very successful, but he would need a massive war chest. So he would need, in my opinion, I agree with you, Tom, upwards of 200 million, if not 250 million quid. He's only going to be there for 18 months, possibly 30 months. So,
but that is the other thing, isn't it? You mentioned Solskjaer and United giving them a chance like that. Maybe Ian will correct me if I'm wrong here, but sometimes I feel like he's gone into clubs at a good moment in the wider context. And that's not me doing, you know, so when I'm talking about Tottenham's prospects, I'm not doing Conte down or Tottenham down necessarily, but you look at the three clubs, Chelsea, Liverpool, Man City, are probably three of the strongest clubs in Europe in this league that he's going at against. So that's why I'm talking about finishing fourth. In some of those other clubs, he's gone in at a good time. You know, with Inter, I think Juve were in a bit of a mess in terms of where they were going, trying to, you know, had Ronaldo, wasn't quite working for them. Chelsea, similarly, that Premier League season, it felt like it all clicked into place in terms of other teams not parting ways for them to storm to the title, but it had that feeling to it. He's got such tough competition. I'm not doing
David
him down.
David Luiz in a back three and Victor Moses at right back.
I'm not doing him down. I'm not doing down the achievement. I'm not doing down the achievement. I'm not doing down the achievement. I'm just saying that now with Tottenham, he's got a good five, maybe even six teams that are already better than him.
Yeah, the competition is very different, particularly to Italy. It's like, you know, I think with a bit of money spent, Inter had a war chest. With a bit of money spent, they allowed him to make up that gap very quickly. I think even, as we're saying, with quite a lot of money spent, it's still a huge gap. The other thing I found interesting, you know, I did a piece from Milan, the Milan Derby, and he's like, one of the things he was always saying when he took the job was he wanted to make Inter credible again. And it's like, I don't know, they're slip, you know, because they had that anthem about Paza Inter, crazy Inter, but they always do something that kind of, you know, Spurs are Spursy. What he will do is make them not Spursy anymore. That's a guarantee. So, you know, I would be very excited if I was a Tottenham fan.
Absolutely. Well, look, Tottenham have solved their managerial quandary very, very quickly. We've got to finish by talking about Newcastle United, who haven't, let's be frank, their managerial search, call it a saga if you will, continues. Villarreal boss Unai Emery, who was very strongly linked to replace Steve Bruce earlier this week. However, he has said in a social media post that Villarreal is my home and I'm 100% committed. So the paper talk has now turned to the former Bournemouth boss, Eddie Howe, as the number number one contender. Before we get to how, firstly, I've got to say, Gregor, Saudi Arabia's PIF fund, the 80% owners of Newcastle United, have not had a good start, have they?
No. And neither, you know, neither is Amanda Staveley. I think she spent so long sort of in the ear of journalists trying to get, you know, the PR tone right in order to complete the purchase of the club, that still it seems that little things have leaked out too early, and Unai Emery has been upset by that. I think really they need to very quickly get a structure in place at that football club and somebody to run it who knows what they're doing. That's it. It seems like Emery has been upset by the fact that the details had emerged and he had a Champions League game to play in. But I wouldn't be surprised either if he sat down and looked at the glare that is on this football club because of who the owners are, and, you know, coming back into the Premier League spotlight and the state that Newcastle are in. And the state that Newcastle are in from top to bottom, as we say, when you go into a football club, you probably want to know who you're dealing with, who's going to be signing the players for you in January, see something, some semblance of a structure. It's understandable he's had second thoughts.
It was being reported by several newspapers that there was a possible clause on the table as well, that if you're relegated this season with Newcastle, it would automatically terminate your contract. So it would be a very short-term appointment had he left, and Newcastle eventually did go down. And rather, I think he would want to leave for the project itself and at least a few seasons to get it started at Newcastle United. But I agree with you. They need someone in place who knows the football, because, I mean, what a shift. Either Unai Emery or Eddie Howe. I mean, come on. What's going on? There seems to be no direction, Tom.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we discussed it when the takeover was announced, and I said, why would you sack Steve Bruce so quickly? And my learned friend Gregor said, you've got to do it because of the optics. But the problem with that is your optics have got to be good consistently. You can get rid of the unpopular guy as long as you've got a plan in place. And those optics are now not looking good for them, because it looks completely haphazard, the process to recruit. You're now going from a guy who's got a team in the Champions League to a guy who's been out of work for about 18 months, I think, turned down or couldn't agree terms on a Celtic job. And also, I don't know whether Eddie Howe's the right man to get them out of this mess. It's not that kind of track record of solidity and tough to break down, was it?
Roy Hodgson.
He's not. I didn't want to bring him up. I know Ian already backs me up on that.
Sam Allardyce is waiting for the phone to ring, isn't he? Right now, he's sitting there every morning like,
you joke,
I'm available.
You joke, but I mean, you never know.
He said himself last season he wants to be that guy that rescues teams. You know, he's comfortable with his position in football now, just waiting for the next, you know, damsel in distress to give him a call, shall we say.
But look, just briefly on that, you know, we've just talked and argued about Antonio Conte, and Gregor's point is right, that even though I was quite dismissive, it sounded like I'd still be excited if I was a Tottenham fan. Incredibly excited. I don't know how many Newcastle fans would be excited about Eddie Howe in the position they're in, with all the fervour and excitement that's gone on around the club. Mike Ashley's out. I think there's a lot of people who are now nervously thinking, oh, this isn't quite as
good
as we
thought
it was.
I think a lot of Newcastle fans would be happy with Eddie Howe, just because in their minds he's perceived as a manager that plays attacking football.
I think there's a lot of baggage around Eddie Howe now, partly because he's born with it down at the end, and partly because he's been out of work for so long now and no one seems to have taken the bite. But it still overlooks a kind of a progressive, young, fairly young English manager who did an extraordinary job. Yes, Bournemouth have a wealthy benefactor. They spent a lot of money to get into the Premier League, but it's Bournemouth. And Bournemouth got into the Premier League under Eddie Howe and stayed there for six seasons, I think. Like, I think it's quite a lot to gloss over if we're saying Eddie Howe is like a massive downgrade on Unai Emery. Unai Emery is a great success in Europe.
He is.
Sorry?
Eddie Howe is a big downgrade on Unai Emery.
Well,
he is.
Okay, but his time in the Premier League was pretty disastrous.
I agree.
You can look at his record. I know this comes up on social media quite frequently. His record is fairly comparable with Arteta's. It certainly was until very recently. And it was a tough job, no doubt, following Arsene Wenger. But I also think there's still quite a lot of baggage around Unai Emery as well.
Ian, is Eddie Howe the answer to this? He survived four Premier League seasons before relegation in his fifth with Bournemouth. Could he get... Yeah, not the worst. Could he get Newcastle firing?
Yeah, I mean, he knows the territory. That's the one thing you could say that he has ahead of Unai Emery. And I think probably the only thing is that...
The territory,
you know,
being a relegation battle rather than English football,
well,
you mean?
Yeah. Exactly, scrapping at the bottom of that. But Newcastle have really, it's really been a salutary lesson, hasn't it, that you present yourself as the richest potentially football club in the world, and then the person you want rejects you for literally the smallest football club that plays in Europe, in what is no more than a small village in the south of Spain. It shows how much Newcastle have been diminished up to the stage of this takeover, and that, you know, they've really got to deal with that situation before they start making great big boasts to good, accomplished, worldly managers.
I find the whole situation to be quite strange. Graham Jones in charge for a couple of games where, for me, Newcastle have got worse. I mean, the first thing you would do, it's urgent. You know, you're in a relegation dogfight. You need the manager in immediately, but you need the right people at the club as well to have no plan. It seems like they had no plan. A technical director, a sporting director, you know, a prospective new manager. You know, it's a crisis. You're 19th in the Premier League for a reason. I just can't believe that they haven't got someone in now. And I think it has to be someone with a record of a strong defence. I mean, at least, like, whatever you want to say about Eddie Howe's football, I don't think I ever saw one of his Bournemouth teams in the Premier League, what you could define as even a good defence, to be perfectly honest. Passable, yes. That's about it. He can't be the guy.
They had a few good moments. Roy Hodgson. No, I'm joking. I won't do it again, because Greg is next to me this time, so he might hit me, unlike last time when it was over Zoom. But no, yeah, I'm with you, Hugh, but It's also coming to a point, we go back to that optics thing again, where they've just got to hire someone now. Because, as you say, Graham Jones, I think, is a talented coach. It's an incredibly difficult task that he was given, taking over in a short time after Steve Bruce. They've just got to pick someone now, haven't they? Because it then becomes about optic. It also becomes about a plan. We're into November now. If they're going to start spending all this money, you've got to pick a manager who can start saying, right, we want to go after him, him and him. You've got to start making those moves before the January window, because you don't want to be leaving it to the last day of the January window. That, again, would be chaotic. That's what they've got to learn from this manager process. They've got to do that with the player signings. If they're getting to January, the middle of January, and they've not signed anyone, that'll again be an absolute shambles, because they've been in place for a couple of months. They should be making these lists, doing their scouting and putting the feelers out there for these transfers. You need a manager in there to start doing that first.
It's just abundantly clear that they were almost as surprised by the speed with which this developed and the sale was, you know, the purchase was completed, as we all were, and they had no real plan in place, and they need to get one pretty sharpish.
We will see what happens with Newcastle United. Just finally on it, people are linking Frank Lampard as well, other managers, Roy Hodgson. Could he really go to Newcastle?
I mean, he won't, but that's the kind of manager that I think they need.
Move on here.
What do you think, Gregor? who do they need?
It's not easy. There's not many names that leap to mind. I mean, Frank Lampard.
Sean Dyche?
Frank Lampard qualified for that. Sean Dyche would be a good appointment, but they won't do it.
Sean Dyche would be a great appointment, because you instantly weaken a rival as well. You take a manager from Burnley, you say, right, we'll take Sean Dyche and James Tarkowski and Dwight McNeil, and here's however many million. Cheers, thanks very much. That probably keeps us in the Premier League and sends Burnley down in our place. Fantastic.
Ian, who would you want in charge? You know, take your pick across Europe if you like.
Roy Hodgson did a superb job saving Fulham in a very, very similar situation some years ago. And then two seasons later, they were in a European final.
There you go. There Voila. You have it. Well, Ian Hawkey, Gregor Robertson, Tom Clark, thank you for being with me on the Game Podcast today. And thank you all for listening as well. Remember, if you're enjoying it, rate us, leave us a review wherever you listen. And also make sure you're subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times. If you sign up today, you can get yourself 1 month free. Go online, check it out. It's thetimes.co.uk/the game. We will see you on Monday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.